and welcome to the Kill Your Darlings podcast. I'm Estelle Tang, the online editor. I want you to picture this. A young Australian woman is waiting at the traffic lights in East Berlin when a tall man with curly hair asks her if she likes strawberries. She says yes, and it's a seemingly small decision that leads to bigger and bigger ones, decisions so big that her life does change forever. This is how Melbourne writer Melanie Yostin's debut novel, Berlin Syndrome, begins, and we're delighted to speak with Melanie today. Melanie, thank you for joining us for this Kill Your Darlings podcast.
Thanks for having me.
In Berlin Syndrome, Claire, she's an Australian photographer, and she decides to go on holiday. She's tired of the demands of her clients and of the trickery that she perceives in her work, and she decides to go to Berlin. Now, Berlin is definitely the kind of city that attracts people who want to be inspired, who kind of want a change in their lives, and I was wanting to ask if you've been to Berlin.
I have, and I strangely did a fairly similar thing to Claire, where I travelled through Eastern Europe for a number of months and then ended up in Berlin for the second time and spent a few weeks there.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what it was about Berlin particularly that made you want to go there?
I mean, there's a lot of artists and writers and musicians there, and it's very alive. It's very cheap. You can actually afford to live there. And it's quite open, I think, unlike a lot of cities. It's open to strangers and, yeah, new experiences.
Yes, and some new experiences are better than others.
Yes.
Find out in the novel. But people, you know, do get inspired to write when they travel because, you know, there's such a richness of experience that you want to transform it from being transient to concrete. You just kind of want to record it and have it forever. And was it when you were physically in Berlin that the idea for this, for Berlin Syndrome, the novel, came to you, or is it a bit later that it emerged?
No, it came to me after I'd been to Berlin the first time. And in many ways, yeah, the novel, it wasn't originally set in Berlin, but I wanted a city that would serve as a metaphor for the rest of the story, and also that had the kind of physical aspects that it needed, which was you know, a city that was constantly being rebuilt and that you could become lost in.
Mm. So you said that it wasn't originally set in Berlin. Was it actually originally set in an actual other city, or
no,
was it kind of a nameless?
No, it was never set anywhere but an apartment. Yeah.
Okay. And what kind of tricked it off for you that you thought that just went right, it should be in Berlin?
Well, the book itself, I suppose, it's a lot about loneliness and captivity. And I was always really interested in stories of the Eastern Bloc and the Berlin Wall, and I just couldn't imagine what it would be like for a wall to spring up in your street or in your city that you just could no longer go where you wanted to go. Yeah. So that kind of became the metaphor that I wanted to play on.
At the same time that Claire's in Berlin, she's constantly thinking about home. So she's thinking about the pub near her house, or her family, or the children's birthday cake cookbook, which I'm sure a lot of readers will kind of recognise. Why does the idea of home then, or Claire's thoughts of home, figure so strongly in the novel?
I think it's, as you said, it's when you're travelling that suddenly everything else in your life is kind of thrown into very sharp relief, and you understand what your life is about, what you're missing out on, and what you don't like about your life. And you tend to remember all of the really nice, lovely things, especially when what you're going through in the present isn't so nice and lovely.
Yeah. Just talking a little bit more about Claire, I responded really strongly to her. I mean, on the one hand, she's super confident, she's really articulate, she's very sociable, and she's passionate. And on the other hand, though, she kind of second-guesses herself, she's always doubting herself, she blames herself, and she's just a really interesting and, to me, very familiar character. And I know, I mean, I've read a couple of reviews where reviewers have found her a bit unsympathetic, but I was the absolute opposite. And I wanted to ask you how you felt about writing Claire.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm very sympathetic towards her because I think she is, a really familiar character to me. I know a lot of people like her, and there's elements of me in there where, you know, you project this self to the world, but inside you're constantly second-guessing yourself. And you know, we live in a world where there's so many stories that you have access to that you can't kid yourself that yours is the first and only time you're going to fall in love, or that anyone's fallen in love, and you're sort of aware constantly of everyone else's stories. So I think she gets caught up in a lot of that, which is why when she meets Andy, she sort of sees him as a bit of stillness or an anchor that pulls her away from all of that.
And yes, Andy, the man with the strawberries, he's a Berlin native who's got somewhat, he's got a somewhat complicated relationship with the past, I think. And not only does he have, you know, the Berlin residence kind of ambivalence towards its history, but he's also, his absent mother is also very strongly in his thoughts from the beginning of the novel. And I wanted to ask what it was like writing about someone who's so closed off to kind of some parts of himself, or who particularly doesn't like to think about some parts of himself.
It's interesting you ask, because I think that's been the other criticism perhaps of the book, is that we get all of Claire's thoughts and not so much of Andy's, or that he doesn't express them as eloquently as she does. But I think that's because he doesn't think as eloquently as she does. Like, he does shut these things off, and he's not sure how to express himself. So he was quite tricky to write, because it was important he be sympathetic, because, you know, I think there's a lot of good things about him. And so it was really tricky not to make him out to be just this very cold, cold-hearted character.
Yeah, it's interesting that from what you were saying about Berlin, that it's so open and so welcoming to strangers. And then you have Andy, who, you know, is... he's probably not Claire's first experience of Berlin, but, you know, he's certainly one of the main things that she experiences while she's there. And he's so closed off, and he people around him, like his Claire is, she's open, and his father is open, and he's very odd.
Yes. It's
almost, I'm trying to find a better word to say it, but yeah, did you find yourself having to cut out things that you wanted to say about him when you're constructing him?
A little bit, because, yeah, he doesn't communicate very well, but he thinks he does, and he thinks he has very understandable reasons for acting the way he does and being the way he is, but no one else would, I guess, agree with that. So it was quite tricky to communicate the character of someone who can't communicate himself.
Yeah. I guess on the one hand, as you say, I mean, he's closed off, but he does know what he wants, and it's a very strange and specific idea. And in that, he's sympathetic too, I think. You know, we all think about love, I suppose, is Andy and Claire. They meet and they kind of plunge into this relationship. Can you talk a little bit about how Andy and maybe how Claire feel about love? Such a big thing.
Well, that was the main, I guess, thrust of the story for me, was what if people just actually did what they really wanted to do, if they forgot all of the social conventions and the expectations and just went right ahead with what they were feeling. And that's kind of what Andy does, and Claire gets swept up in the romance of that idea that then becomes, you know, not so romantic. But I find that really fascinating, that we go through our lives just trusting that everyone will behave themselves, really. And, you know, if people were perhaps more true to themselves and went after what they really wanted, the world would be a very different place.
It's kind of terrifying how quickly it changes from a normal-ish relationship to something that has a much more sinister edge. Was that hard to balance the tension of tipping something so every day into something much more different?
Yeah, it was hard, because I really wanted the reader to feel a little bit complicit, to sort of understand the relationship and like both Claire and Andy and see why they would be attracted to each other, and to see why every step along the way they chose to do the things that they did. And I didn't want the reader to sort of think, oh, I wouldn't have done that. No one would really, you know, go home with someone on the first night or this and that. But it was really important that it just sort of crept up and then suddenly changed, because that's kind of how things happen. There's no big sign that says, hang on, watch out for this guy.
Yes, I know. There should be signs like
yes.
that. And I wanted to ask you, most people have kind of heard of Stockholm Syndrome one way or the other. And I remember, I think the first time I ever heard of it was because of Patty Hearst, the famous heiress who was abducted. And then all those photos of the bank robbery, very crazy.
Yes.
But do you remember when you first heard of Stockholm Syndrome? And I wanted to ask how it became so integral to this story as well.
I don't remember when I first heard of it. But again, I think it was just the it's such a fascinating idea that, you know, you could start to feel empathy and maybe even more for someone who is causing you a whole lot of pain and putting you in the position that you're in. And I just thought, yeah, I can't remember where I first heard of it, but to me it just, it was one step away from a regular relationship, which is a little scary.
Won't dig too deeply into that one. But yeah, I mean, it's, I was reading a little bit about it and it interested me that, because obviously there are all these famous examples and we know about it because it's so odd and so, it's so counterintuitive, not odd. But then there, you know, there are lots of psychologists who say it's a very unusual thing. It doesn't happen to everybody.
No.
But it is a very particular way of coping with something that, something traumatic that does happen to you.
Yeah, and I think that when you break it down to all its little steps, it is more understandable. Like if you're put in a situation that is quite shocking, then yeah, essentially you're in shock, and then the person that's caused this is the only person that's there. And so at first you might hate and despise them, but if they're the only person that's giving you any acknowledgement, you kind of grow to understand where they're coming from. And also there's the whole you're dependent on them that for your life perhaps, or and it's, you know, it's, I guess it's battered women syndrome and, you know, people who don't leave abusive partners, it kind of links into that, where there's that dependency and the idea in some relationships where, you know, they would only act this way because they love me so much, which is quite an intoxicating idea.
Yeah, funnily, you know, funnily Owen Wilson would act that way because he loves me so much anyway. Claire, as we said, works as a photographer and she takes photos of buildings. That's her specialty. Mm-hmm. And you have a history with architecture too, don't you? You used to be assistant editor at Artichoke magazine.
Yes.
And buildings, I mean, they've got such a traceable relationship to human endeavour and intention. And I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about why architecture seemed like such an apt counterpoint in this particular book for you, because Claire, really, she loves those buildings.
She does. And I think that there's something about buildings that they kind of stand watch as, you know, history happens around them and we all live our lives and we don't take a lot of notice of them, I suppose. And I just think the ideas of architecture and the way they influence our lives and how we meet and interact with other people are really quite interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And as much as these, the physical elements of buildings and bodies to feature in Berlin Syndrome, obviously the psychological relationship between Claire and Andy gets very, very complicated. And they play with, you know, power and blame and coercion and all those lovely things that go into a relationship. How did you feel about tackling such troubling subject matter, and particularly from both points of view? I think we've already talked about this a little bit, but...
Well, it was very important, I thought, to do it from both points of view, because otherwise it was just going to be easy to blame one or the other and to not really understand their side of the story. And, yeah, it's, some of it is really tricky stuff to write about, and it's hard not to simplify what can be, I guess, psychological issues that, yeah, have a lot of depth and can be very confusing, and people can, yeah, act one way and then another within, you know, a short period of time. But yeah, I suppose I've been interested in those elements for a while, and while I was editing and writing the book, I started studying social work, which is all linked up with, yeah, psychology and those kind of things. So I think that gave me a lot more confidence to write about these sorts of issues.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, on this, I don't know if this is your intention, but it is a very fair approach to both characters. And obviously you could, as you say, you could look at one and say that you're to blame, or the other and say you're to blame. But is there such a thing as being fair to your characters? Is that something that you thought about?
It was, to the point of I almost destroyed the book at one point.
Oh no.
Because I was being too fair and not willing to place blame anywhere, which obviously doesn't, you know, do much for any narrative tension. But yeah, I think it's, I think for me, the most important thing was that I really wanted the reader to be involved, and I wanted their idea of the characters to change over time, and for them to sort of have to actually decide, do they like the characters? Do they agree with their actions? And if not, why not? Rather than just making it a real simple black and white, right, wrong.
Yeah. And it's apt to ask about a book that is about loneliness. A quote from our friend Franz Kafka. Writing is utter solitude, the descent into the cold abyss of oneself. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, the solitude of writing, especially when you're inside two people's heads?
I would completely agree with that quote. I enjoy writing, and I am quite an introvert and enjoy my own company and isolation, but I couldn't write all day, every day. That's why, I mean, part of the reason I went off to study social work was that so I could actually have a job that would definitely be involved with real people in the real world, because I think writing can be, yeah, for want of a better word, quite mindfuck.
I think that's a very, very apt word. And on the other side of writing, we've mentioned this, but you've also trained and worked as an editor, and I wanted to ask whether that helped or maybe hindered you when you were writing the novel.
It helped. It definitely helped. I studied creative writing in my undergrad degree, and I think that gave me the confidence to write. That editing was what made me, learning how to edit and editing other people's works, made me a much better writer. And yeah, that taught me a lot more than any creative writing class ever did.
Yeah. And final question, Melanie Osten, has anyone kind of tapped you on the shoulder and offered you strawberries since the book's come out?
No, I've been on the lookout. But
it's probably a good thing. Thank you for listening to this Kill Your Darlings podcast. For more information, visit www.killyourdarlingsjournal.com.